We have a very interesting subject this evening, but it is surrounded by extraordinary difficulties. And because these have a direct bearing upon the principal theme, which is a structure of Chinese myths, we must give some attention to them. In the first place, we have almost no knowledge of the origin of Chinese culture. We sometimes feel that China is one of the oldest civilizations of the earth. This is not strictly true. Certainly it is not true in terms of available and useful records. We know much more about Egypt and India than we do of China. The records of the Egyptians go back much further than anything that is recorded in even the oral traditions of the Chinese. The same may be essentially stated for India, which has a much longer, semi-authentic history. The Chinese have also been separated from the common intercourse of the world by an incredible language barrier. It is very difficult for any non-Chinese to acquire a sufficient knowledge of the Chinese language to attempt any scholarly work. The ordinary commercial Chinese can be learned in probably 10 years. But the scholarly Chinese immediately breaks down into a large group of sub-dialectic peculiarities. Not only do we have the various dialects of geographical distribution in China, but we have another dimension of boundaries. This dimension means that a man who became a scholar in literature will be unable to handle most Chinese religion and philosophy in terms of translation. If he is a religionist, he will be unable to translate the political writings. If he is a politician, the scientific writings will be beyond him. The reason, of course, is that the Chinese basic glyphs are subject to many different meanings according to context, and most especially according to the grand area under consideration. Thus, for example, you have to adapt translation of even common figures and ideographs if you are to translate a Chinese religious book. We simply cannot find this common scholarship, the one scholar who, because he is excellent in Chinese, can handle all of these different areas. The areas are very highly specialized. Now, each Chinese word changes not only by these meanings, but by tone. There are four essential tones. The sounds are identical, but the tones differ. And by the tone, the meaning of the word is completely changed. This is almost impossible to learn except by oral instruction. There is no way of determining these tones by which the entire meaning is altered. In addition to this, there is rhythm. And in the Chinese written language, rhythm is to a sentence what tone is to a single glyph. In other words, there are certain ways in which the words are grouped together tonally and rhythmically. And these peculiarities change the meanings of the words, not slightly, but totally. This means that in the course of centuries and ages, the Chinese themselves have been guilty of a great deal of confusion. Most Chinese were not scholars. Therefore, they were inaccurate in their use of their own language. And as a result, words were mysteriously changed meanings were altered. And we have really no idea at the present time as to some of the most important basic words and terms of the language. We do not know how they were originally spoken. We are not entirely sure of how they were written, but we have a fair knowledge of this. But we have even less knowledge of what they meant. Those are language which was rich and scholarly, became a burden upon its own people. The number of separate word forms or syllabic forms is incredible. Between 12 and 15,000 different characters that have to be memorized. The only person who ever graduated from the examination of the classics with a perfect score was Confucius. There is even in China a little deity that rules over the examinations in the universities. It is the duty of this little deity to befuddle the judges so that occasionally someone passes. This is perhaps no more than the summary of an old Chinese experience. We do not have very much religious, philosophical tradition bearing upon the Chinese prior to about 2500 B.C. And at this stage, we have very little better than the most abstract myth. Against the unknown background rises the deified form of the Yellow Emperor. In a way, he was the universal genius of China. He was the father not only of his people, but of all their skills, arts, and achievements. He was said to have been a most benevolent man, but it is not inferred, even in these early discussions, that he actually founded the Chinese culture. It seems that something passed to him, which he took hold of and revised, edited, modernized, brought up to the date of his own time. Where this older tradition comes from, no one seems to be very sure. But it is evident from the knowledge attributed to the Yellow Emperor that he must have had available a great deal of earlier information with which to work. This is especially true in his treatise on medicine, which shows that he had a considerable background in a Kabbalism or mysticism or astromancy or theomancy of still earlier times. Actually, the Yellow Emperor is merely a symbol, a name, against the mysterious background of an unknown time and culture. And it was very long before this culture began to emerge into the light of orderly thinking. The golden age of early Chinese culture was certainly the period which produced within China her two greatest sage scholars, Confucius and Lao Tzu. These men flourished between the 5th and 6th centuries B.C. And of them, China will never cease to honor their names or speak well and kindly words. When I was in Japan last spring, the last Confucian temple in Tokyo, presumably at least, had become partly an art shop, and the proprietress of the shop tried desperately to sell me a picture of Confucius. It was a scroll that was unspeakably bad, artistically. But to this Confucian lady, it was the symbol of all the good and all the wisdom and all the truth and all the virtue that existed in the whole world. And she read me the little poem that was inscribed on the scroll. And it is so typical, I think perhaps you would enjoy it. Wonderful, wonderful Confucius. Before Confucius, there was never a Confucius. At the time of the Confucius, there was not another Confucius. And since Confucius, there has never been a Confucius. Wonderful, wonderful Confucius. Now, the poem was probably worth what she wanted for the scroll, but at the same time, the painting was so bad that it was not very inspiring. But this was the prevailing theory of the times. Confucius to China Well, not the founder of their culture, not the origin of it, was in some way the great personification. Confucius touched the core of Chinese life as no other thinker in the entire history of Chinese civilization has ever succeeded in doing. Around Confucius was built the concept of the sage. And for thousands of years, the sage was the great ideal of Chinese life. The Chinese had a caste system which perhaps originated in India, we are not sure. But anyway, the division was into four orders or groups. The first of these groups, and the highest, was the scholars. The second, below them, was the agriculturists. Then came the artisans, and lowest in the caste scale, merchants. As in other Asiatic nations, merchants did not rate very high. But these four levels bestowed upon the highest level the great applause, and this was the level of scholars. So a great deal has been said, pro and con, on scholarship in China, and here is a very interesting psychological problem. Those who are fairly well acquainted with the subject are of the opinion that Chinese scholars, within the areas of their specializations, were among the most accurate, careful, factual, and faithful recorders of any people in the world. The Chinese scholar would rather die than exaggerate. And yet, when you read very carefully that which he so soberly sets forth, you wonder whether or not he has spent his life in fairyland. It does not seem to fit into the very conservative mind. But the Chinese scholar, in many areas, was as broad and informed a thinker as his world and world conditions would permit. The emphasis was nearly always literary. There being only two important projects with which a scholar could be concerned, history and literature. There was a kind of a half grade somewhere along the line set aside to the astronomers who had to calculate the calendar and regulate the crops. But outside of these areas, there was very little scholarship such as we know it. But it is a mistake to think that this was due to the fact that the Chinese were bad thinkers. There was nothing else for them to think about. The types of scholarship that we recognize simply did not exist in Chinese life. Sciences as we know them had no place. Foreign languages were not considered at all. There was no access to them. China was a strangely remote and isolated country. It lived behind its own barriers for ages. Within these barriers, it built up a very extensive literature, a magnificent poetry, and a very brave and cosmopolitan artistry. But outside the areas of its own special interests, the Chinese simply had no experience. Thus we find the introversion of the Confucian scholarship bringing with it particularly emphasis upon personal conduct. There is no other country that has so emphasized self-discipline, the regulation of personal affairs according to a high code of honor. The whole Confucian code was one of austerity, honor, self-sacrifice, dedication, loyalty, and courage. By means of his very remarkable mind, Confucius was able to dramatize all of these virtues. He also philosophized them, built them into a concept of the state, and on the basis of the concept of the superior man who possessed these attributes, Confucius developed his idea of a world democracy. In this he was far ahead of his time, for many of his concepts are as true and valuable today as when he spoke them 25 centuries ago. Confucius, therefore, was the man of formalities. He was something like the reactionary mind of our modern world. He held strongly to tradition. He was responsible for the recognition that the future must be governed by the past, that all things arise from past experience, and that nations become strong to the degree that they value their traditions, defend and support in their own conduct the high concepts of their ancestors. It was inevitable, therefore, that the older Chinese concepts of ancestor worship should have been strongly intensified by the Confucian Code. The Confucian Code made each person responsible to his ancestors for all of his conduct. Any dishonor, any disloyalty, any neglect, any misuse of power or authority disgraced not only the living person, but his ancestors to the beginning of time and his descendants on to the unmeasurable future. Therefore, the Chinese scholar lived sort of wedged in between his ancestors and his descendants. And in this position, he had responsibilities to both. And these responsibilities, while they might be a little depressing in their severity, certainly maintained for the Chinese intellectual a comparatively high standard of conduct, causing him to value his honor and his intelligence, his integrity, above most of the selfish things that we value today. In old Chinese philosophy, wealth was not a valuable asset. Confucius did not believe in wealth. He believed in virtue. He believed that man to be rich who had disciplined himself, that man to be great who truly became the servant of all other men. So the Confucian Code bound the home together. It dictated the reverences and venerations of the living to the dead and to each other while alive. This code sort of gave a backbone, a very strong, enduring quality to Chinese character. And I suspect this is one of the reasons why China has many times been invaded and conquered by foreign powers, but in the end, it absorbed them all, and nothing remained but Chinese. Chinese culture took over. The second great cultivating and civilizing force of China was the rise within their own nation of the mystic and transcendentalist Lao Tzu. Lao Tzu was the exact reverse of the formalities of scholarship. He was a rebellion against the academic approach to life. He was a creature of freedom of soul. He believed in a strange, deep wildness, in the passion to be wise, to be strong, to be good. There was still a tremendous adventure. And so to Lao Tzu, the formalities were secondary. A man's real purpose was to reach out with an experience of heart, soul, and mind, and come into a benevolent degree of understanding between himself and everything else that existed. Lao Tzu, therefore, took a very much older term, Tao, and applied it to this concept of a universal, all-permeating life. A life everywhere and in everything that could be experienced. A life that cut through all stations and all levels of social advancement or prestige, and brought the common man and the great man into common unity with truth itself. In the beginning, as might be imagined, the philosophy of Lao Tzu was entirely too abstract for the average person. Taoism was in a dilemma from the beginning. Obviously, it would be rejected by the Confucian intellectuals. The second thing, it would be unintelligible to the masses. There was really nothing left. The great levels which dominated Chinese culture were all addicted to other pursuits. And Taoism remained an almost mirage-like structure for a good many centuries. It had a few followers, most of them rebels like Lao Tzu himself, individuals who departed from the world for one reason or another, retired into distant places to cultivate the monastic mysticisms that are born in some men, but which very seldom appear in numbers sufficient to balance other forces in society. Taoism remained comparatively unfruitful in Chinese life until it was able to borrow help and encouragement from another system. This other system was Buddhism. And because Buddhism and Taoism had so much in common in the terms of their transcendentalisms, in their recognition of invisible, mystical, idealistic factors, they formed a kind of fraternity. Buddhism probably realized that Lao Tzu had derived much of his inspiration from the ancient manuscripts and books that had reached him from India. As librarian of the great library of the Chu, Lao Tzu had access to much of the wisdom literature of Asia. In any event, the Buddhists reaching China found that something similar to themselves had already arisen there. And this thing that had arisen was Taoism. Of course, it had a strangely florid complexion. The Taoism of China was far more fanciful than the teachings of Gautama Buddha. But there were these subjective similarities that could not be overlooked. Buddhism, of course, came from India and found its peculiar place in Chinese life. It is easy to understand why the Chinese would need it, why it meant something to them so important that they took hold upon it. The reason was not the same, for instance, that made Buddhism acceptable to the Japanese. The Japanese were at the beginning of a culture desperately striving to build a civilization. The Chinese already had a culture and a civilization long before Buddhism reached them. So in China, it was intended primarily to enrich the inner consciousness of the individual and to give a long-range perspective of human origin and destiny, something at that time lacking among the Chinese people. Buddhism brought to them worship. Worship in an intelligible way. A worship that permitted the individual to find certain venerable beings or venerable principles worthy of his worship and his acceptance. Buddhism mingling with Taoism produced a very interesting polyglot. The Buddhists began to take on some Taoistic attributes, and Taoism was practically reformed. Out of the Buddhist contact came, we might say, religious Taoism, or a formal theological system, such as now exists in China. From the Buddhists, the Taoists took their concept of the temple, the altar, the clergy, brought various symbols together, created their parallel triads, evolved their doctrines of saints and superphysical beings, all organized gradually into patterns based upon Buddhist thought. Thus, they had a considerable indebtedness, and they recognized it, and Buddhism and Taoism managed to get along pretty well in China. There was very little real antagonism, perhaps a little, you might say, jealousy on the part of the Taoists because they were not quite as successful as the Buddhists. But both Taoism and Buddhism had to unite against the common enemy of Confucianism. They would not have had any trouble with Confucius, but Confucianism had changed considerably by the time the partnership between Taoism and Buddhism was completed in the early years of the Christian era. The Confucian Code was very reactionary, and of course, rather morally materialistic. Confucius was an ideal moralist in a sense, but he refused to consider much of anything except behavior. He was perhaps the great Chinese behaviorist. He was not much given to hope of what lay beyond the grave. He had no real concept of universal laws behind human behavior. He was tied to a strange combination of intellectualism and early deity worship that had come down from very much older times in Chinese history. The Confucians, therefore, represented a kind of intellectual aristocracy, and they intended, if possible, to hold this position at all costs. They surrounded the emperor and dominated the Chinese government for centuries. And under this domination, every effort was made to kill out what might be termed the mystical content in religious living and thinking. Everything was reduced to its formality. Now, the same thing happened in Korea, which came very strongly under these pressures, being so nearly related to China. The great creative period in Korean art and religion, philosophy, was the Buddhist period. But at the beginning of the Yi Dynasty, the ambitious rulers realized that the advancement of temporal power, the conquest of new territory, the taking on of colonies, the expanding of temporal authority, these could not be really achieved while Buddhism dominated Korea. What happened was that when the Emperor of Korea wished to raise an army, all the young men became Buddhist monks and wouldn't fight. To meet this, the Korean government outlawed Buddhism. Now, the same thing happened to a measure in China. When peace and happiness and security seemed to reign, the Taoists and the Buddhists had a small chance of things. But whenever it seemed that severity of some kind or another, wars, internal disturbances, threatened the security of the central government, then the Buddhists were persecuted, simply because they would not play party politics. This went on for a great many centuries, on and off, down through time. And the Confucian-Taoist-Buddhist fight was finally carried to Japan, where at various periods the Buddhists triumphed and at other times the Confucianists took over. It was a struggle between two opposing concepts. The Confucianists gave to Japan the code of Bushido, or the code of the samurai, the high-minded one, who lived the most severe and austere life, bound by dedications of absolute loyalty and required by the simple code of the samurai to die without hesitation or a moment of regret in the service of his lord. There must be no question about this absolute fidelity. This was obviously a Confucian factor. Well, these codes went back and forth in China. And by degrees, among the various patterns that crisscrossed and made new combinations and got mixed up with some very bad language forms, there came a series of designs which we now recognize as the essential tapestry of Chinese mythology and lore. I think we can say that the Chinese had one of the most unique concepts of the universe that we have in mythology. They simply divided the world in which we live into two parts, one visible and the other invisible. And the invisible was an exact duplicate of the Chinese Empire. It was the same in all essential respects. The invisible China, for which it really was, had its own emperor. It had its mandarins and its high court officials. It had its statesmen and scholars and agriculturists and merchants. It had everything of visible China. It also had something that you do not find in most other mythologies, the power of advancing and degrading the gods themselves. In other words, if one of the high deities of China antagonized a higher deity of China, the higher deity could demote it, exile it. And if this deity had offended greatly and required the most unbelievable torment, the higher god could force him to be reborn in this world, which was regarded as about the worst thing that could happen to anyone. Also over there, godlings of secondary and tertiary importance, by extraordinary vigilance or fidelity to office, might be advanced, so that a god of the third estate might in time work his way up to a higher station. It's all rather interesting because it was so closely related to a highly materialistic concept. It was simply that the invisible was an abode of beings, many of which owed their divine estate to man himself. We have some other religions that have this peculiar practice of saying who is divine and who is not, but the Chinese worked it to a very high degree. Therefore, the emperor of China himself could make or name a god who would thereafter have a high position in the invisible universe. If one of the emperor's descendants didn't like this god, he could degrade him. There was nothing permanent in heaven any more than on earth in the Chinese way of things. The Chinese heavens, if you want to say that, the invisible world of things, was populated with the most grotesque assortment of miscellaneous divinities that has ever been assembled in any theology. There is nothing remotely like it anywhere. One of the reasons there's nothing remotely like it is because there's no special order in anything. There is no single tree upon which all these gods and godlings grew. They are not there for any particular organized purpose. Most of them were as self-centered as the mandarins on earth. They had their own private prerogatives. They had the various tasks that were appointed to them. They fulfilled many different offices, much of the fulfillment consisting of little more than growling in their beards. There does not seem to have been any active symbolism around a central core, such as you find in most religions. It would be almost impossible to try to fit a moral code into this pattern, or fit this pattern into any ethical system. It does not break down symbolically and into any nice, clean cosmological structure. It is a mass of circumstances which seem to have arisen over very long periods of time in different areas, in different culture levels, and according to different codes of conduct, all dumped together into this mysterious place that is just beyond the grave. But this place was divided, of course, as in almost all religions, into abodes of punishment and reward. And there was no one that could work out a more incredible group of punishments than the Chinese. Not only were they famous for their torture devices for the living, but they continued these in a marvelous way into the regions beyond the grave. Some of their suggestions, however, were not too bad. They had a very terrible torture and an absolute agony forever to any individual who mutilated a good book. That was a very serious offense. Any individual also who stole anything from the poor had a very bad time of it. And individuals who took public charity funds and used them for personal gain went into one of the deepest pits of perdition. They also had a very horrible penalty, something like being drawn and quartered forever, for any individual who knowingly circulated a book, a story, an article, or anything which would tend to lower morality. You might need that old saw around here sometime. But each of these various tasks was set aside to some god, godling, or goblin. There was a particular deity who had charge of every one of these innumerable tasks. And when the deities themselves assigned someone to the care or to the punishment of one of these other godlings, the whole matter, even in the invisible world, was one of high ceremonialism. Even the gods did not speak to each other unless formally introduced. The formalities of the Confucian code went right on into the other world. Now, how did the gods of the other world get there? Where did they come from? Apparently, here again, no one was quite certain that many of these deities belong to some primitive theology that possibly came from further to the west, perhaps even as far as Persia or Arcadia. This is quite probable, but I think we may say that most of the gods of the Chinese pantheon were deified human beings. Each one of them was backed by a legend of his own earthly existence. Represented a reward for some kind of a peculiar achievement, great courage, great dedication, great self-sacrifice. All of these, if they reached a degree of noteworthiness, could well start someone on the way to canonization. I think we might say that the gods of the Chinese invisible universe could be parallel to the statues of famous persons in the Hall of Fame. We have a Hall of Fame for them here. They did not have anything like that in China, so they simply turned the invisible universe over to them. And they carried on various tasks. They enjoyed themselves. They fulfilled the merits which they had earned living, performing various duties. They were not completely idle. They had to sort of administer the destinies of these human beings who are constantly moving from the visible world of man into this invisible region, which was so highly fantastic that it appears that the Chinese finally gave it up themselves. The Chinese did not seem to be too much concerned with any of this. By the time Buddhism took hold, the whole situation was too confusing and too comparatively irrelevant. The one exception to all this, of course, was the ancestor. Among the deities were deified emperors, obviously, the great deified councilors of state, the few victorious generals the Chinese were ever able to canonize, because they were not particularly successful in military operations. Scholars, poets, literary men, artists, musicians, and a whole variety of faithful mortals of lesser estate who were associated with some great deed of virtue or goodness, like the famous series of the 24 examples of filial piety, in which children really attained immortality because of their virtuous care of their parents under the most difficult situations. So into this invisible realm also passed the ancestors. And in China, an individual became a little bit divine simply by the process of dying. It wasn't quite true, however, because there could be living gods. Ancestors could be divine while they were alive, but they at least rose one step after they passed out of this life. But the veneration for ancestor drifted very close toward true worship. And in the patriarchal system of these people, the living ancestors were of the highest importance. And when they disappeared and their tablets were placed in the ancestral shrine, they were almost gods. They could be besought to to help in all kinds of emergencies. There is a little bit of parallel between this concept and modern spiritualism, with the exception that in China, this spiritualism was largely a family affair. They did not really expect the descendants of other families to be concerned with them. It was only their own who would continually watch over them and would guard them and would make an unbroken line of virtue between them and the first cause of things. Little by little, however, this immense pantheon began to lose most of its vitality. Polytheism here went to such an extent that it lost central strength. It lost a basic core, even in the matter of the principal deities, and there was a monotheism underneath all of this. It is hard to differentiate just who the one God actually was. He was known to be there, but it was very hard to discover him, to identify him. Finally, the Chinese, God-ridden in the most abundant manner, began, as we have said, to break away from this very confusing situation. And from this tendency to break away, aided and abetted by the Confucians, the Taoists themselves, and the Buddhists, we find the gradual emergence of a more or less unified Chinese mythology. It is not unified as the Greek is, or as the Japanese is, but it is unified comparatively in terms of that which preceded it in China itself. And out of this general unification of things, there came a very interesting basic legendary. A legendary that more and more shows influence from other outside sources, but was certainly made Chinese in every sense of the word by the beliefs and policies of the state and also of the people. In this more or less simplified form, a pattern of achievements was set up, and there arose among the Chinese thinkers this concept of the immortals. This was also a very interesting Chinese phase. The immortals were mostly Taoist in origin. They took on many of the austerities and the formalities of the Confucians, and they were, to a measure, given form, appearance, likeness, and a state by the older teachings from India of the Lohan, Ahat, Rishis, and Mahatmas. But the immortals came to be the Chinese first line of invisibles, and they were not entirely invisible for that matter. But the immortals were divided into three orders, or three ranks in China. The first rank was simply called the immortals. The second rank was referred to as the heroes. And the third and highest rank was referred to as the saints. So thus they more or less fall under our idea of canonization to a certain degree. Buddhism molded the characteristics of these immortals to a considerable degree. But at the same time, the magic and alchemy of Taoism and the strange ancestral patterns of Confucian worship were also present. What was a Chinese immortal? He was a person who usually had departed completely from the world. He was a hermit or a forest dweller. He was one who had dedicated himself to the attainment of insight, to the unfoldment of his own mystical and divine nature. He was a person of great determination and of high integrity, Confucianism. He was a person who believed that there were secrets by means of which the regeneration of his own body could be accomplished, that by the use of alchemies he could form universal medicines, and that by the study of the stars he could bind to himself the genii of planets. Taoism. He also affirmed or believed that by these meditative and other disciplines, he could become free from the contamination of worldly illusion and finally enter into the presence of infinite and total reality, Buddhism. So our immortal had all of these characteristics. Another peculiar thing about immortals, in fact, most of the deities of China, is that their artistic representation is a little difficult for us. So many of these deities, although of benign nature, are presented in the most grim and foreboding appearance. They are not a cheerful lot by any means, nor are they outstandingly handsome, although perhaps they look better to the Chinese than they do to us. But for the most part, they are rather grotesque theater creatures, more like the actors in some ancient Chinese play than deities presumably having spiritual powers in another life. The immortals gain certain knowledge by austerity. The code was rather simple. In order to gain something of the invisible world, you had to give up something here. The more you gained over there, the more you had to renounce here. But this renunciation was not a deprivation. For what you gained in insight was worth infinitely more than you renounced to get it. Thus, the Chinese immortal, having renounced anything like nation, country, family, home, village, the little piece of land on which he dwelt, was rewarded for giving up this little square of earth by being made a citizen of the whole world. Instead of being bound to his community, no matter how high he might be elevated as a local magistrate, he became capable of traveling with the speed of thought into all the parts of the world. As a result of giving up a certain kind of wealth that he might accumulate a few dollars here, he gained the mysterious wealth of being able to produce at will anything he wanted out of his own consciousness. Step by step, he departed from the world by attaining to privileges and powers and values that are entirely apart from this world. The end of the immortal, as far as in Chinese thought, is that he would attain what the term implied, immortality. He would never die. He could take on bodies whenever he pleased. He could take on any form that he wanted. But he could never die. Therefore, whenever he disappeared, people said he was dead, but he appeared somewhere else. And like the strange, mysterious masters of alchemy, he traveled about the world in disguise. He took any form he wanted to. He had magical powers and mystical abilities. He was like a genie. He was a truly wonderful being who appeared to be mortal, but could fly around the air on the backs of cranes or ride across the sea on the back of a fish. He had a horse. One of the immortals had a horse that he kept in a gourd on his belt. And every time he wanted to, he opened the gourd and the horse came out, became full size, and he rode off on the horse. When he was tired of the horse and wanted to stable it, all he just did is hold out the gourd and the horse went back into it again. He created anything he wanted. He had anything he wanted. But in order to achieve this, he must want nothing material. He must give up every desire for material things. Here we have, as I think you can gather, a series of different culture factors. This rejection of materiality, this attainment of limitlessness by transcending the concept of limitation is almost certainly Buddhist in its beginnings, or else arises from the earlier Hindu schools from which Buddhism itself came. The mysterious miracles, the horse and the gourd and other things, are a pure metaphysics of late Taoism. And this rigid code of self-conquest by which the immortal achieved through complete sacrifice and integration and dedication would be a little of the Confucian spirit. So he really represented all three. Now, above the level of the immortal was the next higher, and that was the hero. Now, the hero was much in the same spirit as the Greek heroes. Just as Achilles and Ulysses and Aeneas and others of the great heroic order of the Greeks were immortalized by the gods for some extraordinary achievement, so in China, the heroes represented the persons who did not enter into this dream of immortality by long self-discipline, but by some one or small group of transcendent actions by which their highest integrity was demonstrated beyond question. The hero was always the person of self-sacrifice, but he might also be a person of transcendent wisdom. He was someone so good, so noble, so great, that all who came after him venerated his name. He was a symbol sometimes of unusual righteousness under tremendous provocation or temptation to dishonesty. But he had to be a person who won a great battle against weakness, against evil, against some force contrary to the total good of mankind. So the hero, when he arose with all these attributes, was simply picked up and taken to heaven, like the Greeks of the ancient legends, to become a star or a constellation or to have some wonderful place in the invisible universe of things. The third level of the immortals was the saints. And the saints, of course, did not take on very much Confucian coloring. They were mostly a mingling of Taoism and Buddhism. The saints were a little different from the immortals. The immortals had more of the tinge of the magician in them. They were wonder workers. They were strange, sprightly creatures who really fulfilled our idea almost of pixies or of strange, wonderful sprites. They were in human form, and they might be very elderly gentlemen of misshapen body or strange, distorted expression. But they were kind of crafty. They were clever. They had a strange, wild sense of humor. And also, down underneath it all, there was a kind of selfishness in them. They were searching for one thing, and they found it: immortality. And they found it by means of the cultivation of magical arts. Like the dream of Faust, it had about it a certain strange, subtle self-seeking. The true saint in China was free from all of this. The true saint was the benefactor and the intermediary. The saint in China was more like the concept of the Christian saint. Prayers could be addressed to him. The saint in China was the one who could intercede between mortals and someone of these great courts of justice or injustice that governed the invisible universe. The saint was unworldly, absolutely pure, without self-interest of any kind. He had renounced even immortality. He didn't ask for it. And because he had renounced both life and death, he entered living into the state of eternity. He was really approaching the Buddhist concept of nirvana. He was in this great experience of total selflessness. There was no longer a desire to live or to die. There was simply this inevitable urge, an irresistible pressure to be of service to mankind. And this, of course, was very largely shaped from Buddhism. But these three together represented a kind of ascending order of human regenerated persons. But we know there's another factor that arises in this that parallels to some measure Tibetan philosophy. That is that from all of these legends, there comes the brief suspicion that gains ground, however, that in some way these stories are ritualistic. Just as there is much evidence, for example, that the Apocalypse of John was originally used as a ritual of initiation into the early Christian mysteries, so it would seem that these Chinese legends, particularly those of the three immortals, the three levels of immortals, ties into secret societies and esoteric orders in China. And we are not surprised, therefore, to find the three levels of the immortals in the Hung Association, or the secret Freemasonry of China. We are not surprised to see the candidate advance from one degree to the next, until finally he attained to sainthood. Ritualistically and symbolically, his advance represented the unfoldment of his own internal life. So out of the mingling of these three religions, Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism, there finally did come an integrated concept of human growth. A human growth dependent upon the understanding of universal laws and man's personal obedience to these laws. So now we can get a little kind of look at the Chinese universe. The Chinese universe was brought into existence as a result of the mingling of two principles, the yang and the yin. These principles were in the form of air. And from the union of these two airs whirling together, there came into existence the mysterious symbol of the yin-yang, the circle that is divided into two comma-like parts. The mingling of these two forces produced the first being. And this first being is perhaps very closely related to Ymir in the Scandinavian rites, the frost giant from whose body the world was fashioned. But from the body of the first Chinese being, the world itself was formed. This being is usually represented in ancient art as a rustic, or a person of the soil, an agriculturist, or something of that nature, dressed in leaves, and sometimes carrying in his hands the symbol of the sun and moon, or of the trigrams, or of the great combinations of the characters associated to Fu Yi. This being is distinguished from other characters in Chinese mythology by the fact that he is very human in appearance, but has two short, knobby horns on his forehead. Now, this was the being from whose body later all things of the earth were fashioned. And it was out of the disintegration and decomposition of this being that all creatures came forth to begin the population and the covering of the earth's surface with life. There then appeared two beings, a male and female principle, one representing the male part of the yin and the other the female. And they are represented as two beings with bodies of serpents and human heads. And one of them carries the architect's square and the other the architect's compass. And because of the fact that these two primordial artificers carried the compass and square gave also further encouragement to a possible Masonic interpretation of the symbolism. In any event, these two beings, brother and sister, both with their bodies ending in serpents, brought forth the organized architectural concept of the world, placed it upon its foundations, and set it up very much according to the Hindu theory. The world was divided into continents. It was formed into great circles, in the midst of which rose a mountain. And this mountain, which came from the very center of a sort of flat dish-like earth, was the same Sumeru, Meru, of Kailasa, the great mountains of the religions of India, Tibet, and Chinese Buddhism. This mountain was the axis mountain of the world. And upon the slopes and crest of this mountain was the abode of the gods, particularly the superior beings. Now, the Chinese do not have quite the concept, as we've suggested, of superior beings that we understand in our way of thinking. For the abstract and eternal being, they were perhaps a little inclined to the concept of Tao, the nameless, the thing that could not be described, the spirit that could not be measured, could not be symbolized, could not be revealed by any definition possible to man.